You're listening to Greater LA from KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chitakis. I'm walking up this nice pathway with Francis Anderton, our design and architecture expert. Hi, Francis.
Hello, Steve.
So we are going to the home of Russell Brown. We're in Bronson Canyon. And Russell heads up this nonprofit called Friends of Residential Treasures Los Angeles. And today, it's all about stilt houses. Have you ever, Francis, gone down, obviously you have, those canyon roads, Coldwater, Laurel, Beverly Glen, you know, between the west side and the valley, and you see all of those precariously placed homes on stilts?
I certainly have, Steve, and I've probably had the same reaction as you have, which is, oh my goodness.
How can you live in something like that?
What are they like to live in?
Well, let's talk to Russell about it right now. Russell Brown.
Hi, Steve. Hi, Francis.
Hey. Hi, Russell.
Nice to see you.
Lovely to see you.
Oh, my God. I feel like this old house, right? It's Pavila. Oh, my God.
This old house is not like a stilt house at all.
No, we are on solid ground right now.
Absolutely.
Here in Bronson Canyon, and we're going to take a trip. We are, oh, my goodness. We're going to talk about stilt houses. We're going to go on a little tour of the stilt houses in the canyons, and let's go. Another hot day in L.A. Turn on the air conditioning, for God's sakes. Oh, thank God. Whew. So here we are. We're driving from Bronson Canyon, and we're about to go from Bronson Canyon up.
And Steve, you know, some of the stilt houses we're going to see today are sort of famous movie stilt houses. That's the theme of the Fort L.A. Trail that's coming out in August.
Francis, are stilt houses unique to L.A.?
Well, they're not entirely unique, but I think L.A. made them iconic.
And Russell, what is it that got you into the, I'm going to talk about stilt houses and make a guide about it?
Well, there's something kind of very specific about the way that filmmakers and artists, I think, have portrayed stilt houses in their work. You know, it's always characters who are sort of on the edge or... who are
literally.
And it's really interesting that I think that's what filmmakers do, is they kind of interpret the space and architecture around them to best tell their stories. So the first house we're going to is the Garcia House, which is a John Lautner house. And it's most famous for its appearance in Lethal Weapon 2. It's the home of the sort of villainous, evil drug dealer who is trying to take down Mel Gibson and his partner. But the character really, truly is kind of an evil, horrible person, so you don't feel too bad when his stilt house comes crashing down.
But good people can live in stilt houses, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, a bit later in this tour, we're going to meet some good people who live in stilt houses. And I do want to just add that these days, stilt houses can sell in the millions. However, when they were originally built, and there's about 1,500 of them in LA, they went up in the mid-century period, and they were actually generally aimed at a kind of a middle-class person on a middle-class working salary. And they were dreamed up as a somewhat affordable solution to building on extremely steep, difficult sites.
I mean, I think Los Angeles's residential architecture is really what defines the kind of aesthetic of the city.
And
I think
we're going to visit
up to the Garcia House right now.
Oh, wow. It really is on stilts.
So this house was actually built for Russell Garcia, who was a composer and sort of best known as the arranger of the music for Charlie Chaplin's film Limelight. And other sort of famous people have lived here. Vincent Gallo lived here. And, you know, it's sort of an incredible view. And you can really get a feel for John Lautner's architecture by looking at this house from this kind of position.
Well, it's key that you brought up John Lautner, because we're looking at what is a very grand version of a stilt house. Several of the stilt houses are pretty much a kind of a box on stilts. This one, as you see, has this incredible parabolic roof. It's got amazing stained glass windows. It's very, very large. It's deep into a landscape that is just, you know, bursting with foliage. It's an incredible structure.
How does a house like this survive an earthquake?
This one has stilts that go 60 feet into the ground below. So these are all about the engineering. They're all about getting those posts deep in. So they're almost like tree roots in a way.
Should we go to the next one?
Yeah.
Let's get in.
Here we are. Here it is. This is the house that Geneviève Bujold in Earthquake almost gets crushed by it.
God.
Yeah. There's a 9.9 magnitude earthquake in the film.
Yeah.
And this house topples down the side of the hill.
And it is up high and on stilts, and those things don't look very strong, but man, that thing's probably been through a lot.
So we're beneath these houses in this parking lot, and there are several. The earthquake house, as you mentioned, but also a couple of other houses nearby, next door, and they look like they could fall down the mountain at any time.
Yeah, in the movie Earthquake, it does fall down the mountain.
Yeah.
It was obviously a model in the movie, and the film actually won an Oscar for its visual effects. This house actually gets destroyed by an earthquake in another television, in The Incredible Hulk. So it's died on screen multiple times,
wow.
This house.
Do people build these houses anymore? Are there stilt houses still being built in L.A.?
Not with structure as elemental as this. Back in the 1960s, it was actually discovered that there was a bit of a fire risk, with fire coming up underneath the platform. So fire code... meant you needed to put much more proofing on the structure. That added cost. And then following the Northridge earthquake, when 13 stilt houses did come down, codes were tightened again. Now, these are all houses, if they have any structural weaknesses, they have been fortified. Absolutely. People living in them now can feel very confident that they're just fine. And we're going to meet some people that do. Lorraine, very nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
I'm Frances Anderton, and here's Steve Chiodakis.
Hey, nice to meet
Hello.
You. Wow. Look at this. Wow. May we come in?
Sure.
All right. No, it's lovely. So this is very mid-century, right?
Yes.
Built when?
Built in 1966.
Okay,
yeah.
And look at the view you have. So... when you first bought this house, I have to ask you, was it one of those, did the notion in your head be like, how does this stay up here?
Not at all.
Not at all?
No, not at all. I first leased this house, and then I felt so secure, I bought it. But when I was looking for a house coming, I just had just moved, was moving from Manhattan. I was not looking for a stilt house. So I fell in love with the house without the stilts. I love good architecture. I love nature. I love light. I love the unexpected, and I love the unusual. So I get all of that here. I feel very safe in this house. I do not lose sleep over whether this house is going to be here tomorrow.
This set of houses that we're in were originally conceived by an architect called Richard Neutra. Neutra's idea was to live lightly on the land. He wanted to raise the house above the land so the flora and the fauna could still grow.
Yes, exactly, because there is a lightness of being with this house, and you sort of... you know, it's kind of like living in a treehouse. You're living above the earth, and you are living among the trees.
So let's take a look at the balcony. Again, such a beautiful spot. Oh, my. We are way up here. Wow. You can see there's the valley over there.
Mm-hmm.
There's Mulholland that way.
Mm-hmm.
There's a beautiful breeze. It's a day seemingly, what, I think the high today was 90 or something like that. It doesn't feel like that right now.
No, there's no air conditioning on. I like to live with my windows open and my doors open, and thankfully I can do that here. But, yeah, it's kind of its own little area.
Lorraine Johnson, thank you for inviting us into your home. Lovely home at that.
Oh, well, it's a pleasure having you come by.
So you said there's another house, right, on the street
that
is very similar to Lorraine Johnson's.
That's right. The house that we just saw is part of a development that was called the Stonefisher Development. The development company hired Richard Neutra to design this complex of houses. There was a little bit of dispute about the way in which the houses were built, and subsequently a different designer finished the project, William Beckett. Subsequently, in the Northridge earthquake, three of the structures did come loose from the street, and a little girl, a four-year-old girl, was actually killed. So these houses have been, very much strengthened since then. And the lady that we're going to meet, Michelle Johnson, she lives in a house that has gone through some significant upgrades, actually, both in the structure and the way she's arranged the interior of the building.
All right, well, let's meet Michelle Johnson, shall we? Hey.
Hello.
Hey.
Great to see you all.
Michelle Johnson, Steve Chiodakis.
Steve, pleasure to meet you.
Frances Anderton.
Hi,
hello,
Frances.
Michelle.
Nice to meet you.
Oh, lovely.
And hi, Russell Brown. Nice
hi,
to meet
Russell.
You.
Russell. Nice to meet you. Come right in.
Oh, this is lovely. Wow. And air conditioning.
Yes.
No need for cross ventilation. You've got this view that, again, the other Lorraine Johnson, no relation, by the way, has the same view, except she has a balcony. You have it entirely glassed in, but you still have this gorgeous, you know, Beverly Glen. You've got the canyon that you're overlooking. What brought you here?
Right. Well, largely this. I mean, I just wanted beautiful. I wanted something that was interesting. I wanted something that was exceptionally well-made and exceptionally well-maintained and something that had a great view. And I wanted to be in the hills. So, you know, we came in January. We looked at maybe 20 houses. It was a lot of fun, but it was just abundantly clear this was the one for us.
This was the one. So that drew you here. You know that being higher up, you know, has, I mean, it's the allure is the view, but what's beneath you maybe can make you quiver just a little bit?
A little. I mean, it takes a little getting used to, but it's, you know, I trust the architecture, right? It was built in 1965. It survived the 94 earthquake. And, you know, Donald Goldstein is an architect himself who reinforced, as I understand it, the point by the street where the other homes disconnected in 1994. So I felt like that gave us some additional assurance. And yeah, it's sort of, you know, it's worth a little risk to live here. It's exquisite. I love it.
Francis, you know, obviously the views from these houses are amazing, but it's also interesting how the houses sort of are light on the land. They look like they're levitating, right?
Certainly, Richard Neutra, this was part of his philosophy. He absolutely believed that you should almost have more land than building that's on the land. He truly believed this was something that would make people feel better, their lives would be better. And so that philosophy met a time when engineers were coming up with ways to build what is essentially a kind of mid-century modern treehouse. And that's what makes these houses so lovely. And, you know, because of the strengthening that's been expected over the years, we're not going to see houses like this anymore.
Russell Brown, we started our tour talking about the movies, right? And the villains that live in some of these houses or the ones that fall down on the hill and the major disaster movies or whatever. But we end it in the real world.
Yeah, I mean, I think Hollywood is using these houses for a very specific purpose. You know, we don't see families raising their kids in stilts houses in the movies, or we don't see happily ever after stories. But the reality is, I think a lot of people really love living here and have, you know, really strongly warm emotional reactions to being here. So I don't know if the movies have totally gotten it right.
This has been an eye-opening experience. Seriously, checking out these houses, the ones that I've always wondered about, looking up at, going through the canyon roads. I want to thank all of you for coming on. Michelle, for letting us into your home. Thank you so much, Michelle.
My pleasure. Glad to have you.
Russell Brown from Friends of Residential Treasures LA. Russell, thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me. This is super fun.
This has been a really great tour. And Francis, as always, it's so nice to travel around LA with you.
Likewise, Steve. It's always a blast.
Coming up, from Hollywood stilt homes to Hollywood standing still, the strike is affecting animals, too. How one company that provides birds and raccoons and bunches of others for TV and the movies is really feeling the pinch. That's yours after this short break.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
More now of Greater LA from KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Much of Hollywood's on strike, of course, which affects people in the business. But it's not just humans who are out of work right now. Animals are also taking it on the chin, or the snout, or beak, as it were. Those trusty pup sidekicks, wisecracking parrots, ferocious bears, even raccoons who work on camera, and of course their trainers and wranglers who are behind the camera. They're all out of work for the most part. Binet Karp is owner of Binet's Bird and Rentals. And they've been in the business now for, oh gosh, more than 35 years. Binay, welcome to you.
Hey there.
Hey there. So you're over there in the San Fernando Valley. Talk about how the strike is affecting you and your animals.
Well, thanks for asking, because, you know, it is affecting everybody in the industry. We're all suffering. For us, I really do feel like we have the worst of it, because not only are the company itself suffering, but the trainers as well. So we have our animal trainers that can do work outside of the industry, but it's very hard to find. Just like other departments, other vendors, you know, we're all struggling to find work to stay afloat and pay our bills with animals, unfortunately. Our bills don't change. We still have an enormous feed bill. We still have vet bills. We have, you know, all the care that goes into taking care of our animals. That doesn't change whether we're working or not. So in addition to having trainers being out of work, we still have those expenses as well. So it's really rough. We've been super fortunate and had several people that have helped donating meat for my carnivores, and we have some volunteers that have been helping to help with the enrichment of the animals, but essentially it's very rough. This is devastating for us.
What kind of animals do you have over there? I mean, are we talking about like tipihedron kind of animals, you know, or I mean, what do you have there in the valley?
I have a very diverse assortment of animals. We have 75 to 100 birds, dozens of different types. We have a lot of small wildlife, raccoons, possums, foxes, coyotes, squirrels, prairie dogs.
And they're all waiting for their next role, right, in a
yes,
movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so if there is no movie, no production being done, you still got to feed them, right? You still got to, I mean, they're
exactly.
Under your care.
That's exactly right. Whether we're working or not, they still eat the same amount of food. They still need the same amount of care. And, yeah.
Walk me through what your morning looks like, you know, feeding them. It sounds like you're near some birds right now doing some cawing, right? Some
yeah.
crowing,
yeah.
whatever it is that those birds do.
Right.
What is it like?
Well, our days typically start at about 6 a.m. I get up, and my day starts at about 6 a.m. I take my coyotes out for walks individually and together before it gets too hot, especially in the summertime. And I usually walk them for 30 to 50 minutes each, and then come in and start to prepare diets. I have a fantastic crew of people that come in every day between 7 and 8 o'clock and spend hours preparing hundreds of diets for our animals. Cleaning takes several hours for all of the enclosures. Ranch repairs are every single day. There's always something that needs to be repaired or replaced. And sometimes we have, vet visits that we have to do. Yesterday I was at the vet for several hours with one of our dogs. Unfortunately, those don't go away either, and those are a big expense as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, talk a little bit about the expense. Tell me, you know, how can you give us a roundabout figure of how much stuff like that costs to care for all these animals, to certainly feed them?
Well, for me, and there are some companies that, have much higher and lower expenses, but my company is between $12,000 and $14,000 a month. For care and maintenance, and that I have to do before my company earns a penny. So right now we are severely in the red. You know, I had always thought 3 months in case of an earthquake or something, we'd have a huge amount of food, and I'd have money put away in case of a catastrophe. And I thought 3 months was a good amount, and COVID taught us that it's not a good amount. So when we did start to recover, come back from COVID, I started saving for hopefully never to happen another catastrophe. And this strike is that for us. So I didn't have enough time to really recover from COVID, but we did have some put aside that's helping us. But we're pretty much at the end of that. right now, so it's very scary.
Are you having to keep training those animals to keep them in I mean, you've got to have them prepared, right? So when the strike is over, eventually the strike is going to end. We don't know when.
Yeah, exactly.
But eventually people will be, and animals, will be going back to work. So you got to keep them ready, right?
Well, you know, that is the good part for us is we do work our animals every day. So that's part of our, we need to work our animals every day, regardless whether they're working or not. So we are spending that time still with the animals, and then more so. I wouldn't be able to take my coyotes out for, you know, a 45 minute to 1 hour walk each every day if I was working on set, you know, 12 to 16 hours. So there is that benefit. So they are getting trained, but more so. And yes, they absolutely need to be worked so that they are ready when the job comes in.
You sound like you have a pretty chatty. Is that a macaw that I hear in the back? It's Pepper.
Yeah, Pepper. Yeah. Pepper's very chatty. Yeah, that's Pepper.
I love it. Oh my gosh. Yeah. To have a voice and to be able to use it on the radio. What's that like? Mm. how many humans work for you, Binet?
I'm a smaller company. I have 5 total. There are some companies that have much more and some companies that just have a couple. So I'm about like right in the middle.
What are your plans for getting through this? I mean, we hear a lot about funds, you know, that people take up, or there, you know, even at the unions, there are funds for actors and writers and even some crew.
Yes.
Are there any things like that for y'all, for the animals and y'all?
That's a great question. Our union is trying to help us with ours because most people are in jeopardy. This is actually probably bigger than other things for most people in the industry is the fear of losing our insurance. And our insurance is based on the amount of hours you get. You have to have X amount of hours in a certain amount of period of time or you lose your insurance. And everybody is about to lose their insurance because we're not working for months and months. You know, people are trying to help us, but we're all in this together. So we're all suffering. We're all trying to help each other, but funds are limited for everybody.
Well, it's getting the information out, too, that it's not just the actors and the writers who are on strike. It affects
exactly
a lot of people and a lot of people in this town. And
it's killing us. It's really, yeah. it's very difficult. The crew is very overlooked and all the people that are on these shows that make them happen, the behind the scenes, behind the camera people who make it happen. But we are all in solidarity. We all believe in the unions. We all want this to end, but we understand what's happening.
I wish you the best of luck, Binet Karp.
Thank you.
Owner of Binet's Bird and Animal Rentals. Binet, good luck to you. Thank you so much for talking with us. Take care of Pepper. And the raccoons and everything else you have on the farm over there in the San Fernando Valley.
Really appreciate that.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow, at this time, at 1 and 6, The Business with Kim Masters and horror and psychological thriller giant Blumhouse Studios and its founder and CEO, Jason Blum. He has some thoughts on Hollywood's current distribution model. That's tomorrow at this time. Next week on this program, Mayor Karen Bass wants to buy the Mayfair Hotel. Maybe you've seen it. It's in the Westlake area near downtown L.A. So there's somewhere to put people moved off the streets by the city's Inside Safe program, but neighbors nearby are objecting strongly. We're going to have that for you next week in a long-standing push to designate one stretch of Pico Boulevard as the Oaxacan Corridor. Those stories and many others on Greater LA next week right here on KCRW. Visit us online at any time at kcrw.com/GLA or check out the iPhone or Android app as well. Juliana Mayo, Zoe Matthews, Celine Mendiola, Phil Richards, Ray Guarna, Katie Gilchrist. Thanks, Katie, for your help in the field. Sonia Geis, Amy Ta, Carlos Ramirez, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all make this show happen. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your time tonight. Thank you for your ear. Have a great night.